Good afternoon. It's Thursday, June 23rd, 2022, and time to read from today's Sioux City Journal. I'm Sandy Barron. I'm a volunteer and pleased to be able to bring you the news today. Here's a look at what we'll be reading. First, we'll read stories of local interest. Next, we'll turn to the opinion page, and at half past the hour, we'll read the obituaries. We'll conclude with sports and feature stories as time allows. First, let's take a look at the weather. Today, breezy, very warm, and more humid with winds out of the south at 10 to 20 miles per hour and a high of 88. Tonight, partly cloudy and humid, winds out of the south-southeast, 8 to 16 miles per hour, and a low of 67 degrees. Tomorrow, breezy in the morning, some sun, and a high of 87 with a low of 67. Saturday, a morning thunderstorm, breezy, with a high of 83 and a low of 58. Sunday will be breezy in the morning, clouds and sun, with a high of 77 and a low of 54. And Monday will have a high of 83 and a low of 58. The sun rose this morning at 5:49 a.m. and will set tonight at 9:06. Tomorrow will be the exact same time, sunrise at 5:49, sun setting at 9:06. Next, here's the mini editorial. This comes to us from the Journal editorial board. If gas prices continue to rise, we'll discover why people say there's no place like home. And again, this came to us from the Journal editorial board. So the first headline on the front page reads market price. And it shows it's accompanied by a picture showing customers browsing C. Brown Gardens and Farm Fresh Beef stand at the Sioux City Farmers Market on Wednesday. Vendors sell produce, meat, eggs, honey, flowers, and other items at stands at the farmers market. This comes to us from Owen Ziliak of the Sioux City Journal. Food prices at the farmers market have climbed this year due to higher operating costs. Despite charging more for their goods, vendors have not seen a decrease in the number of people coming to the market, and business is good. One shopper, Julie Lure from Sioux City, has made changes elsewhere in her life to adjust for rising prices. "I don't travel much, so I save on fuel," she said. "I cut back on utilities like electricity. I keep the air conditioning at 79 degrees. I try to moderate, knowing that everyone is affected." Supporting local businesses is also something that keeps Lure coming back. "I'm here because everything is locally grown, and I want to support these people. And I need fresh greens, and this is the place to get them." Lure said that even if prices continue to climb, she would keep coming to the market. One of the main culprits has been fertilizer. Kenny Tesort of K&S Produce in Battle Creek, Iowa, says the cost of fertilizer to grow his crops has been a primary factor in the move to raise prices on produce. "Fertilizer doubled. That hurt," said Teets. "Other things might have gone up, but they didn't hurt a lot. And that means I have to raise the prices. You have to do it, but some things you have to do. You hate to do it, but some things you have to do." According to Data Transmission Network, the cost of a ton of retail potash has more than doubled since May of last year. The cost of diammonium phosphate, a popular phosphorus-based fertilizer, has reached levels not seen since 2008. Fertilizer is not the only commodity hurting Teetsort's pockets. The Battle Creek farmer also keeps chickens and sells their eggs, and he feeds the animals with corn. "The feed has gone up significantly," he said, "so I am raising the price of eggs and chickens too. Corn is at $7 or more. Protein's up higher than that because soybeans cost more. A bushel of corn, or 56 pounds, costs $7.61 as of June 21st. The cost of a bushel at the beginning of the year was just under $6. Clint Brown of C. Brown Gardens and Farm Fresh Beef also spoke on rising feed costs. "We have had to raise our prices because what we feed is going up," said Brown. "Mineral costs have at least doubled. We don't like to raise our prices, but to make profits, we need to. For some farmers, the price of fuel has been a contributor to higher prices. But for Brown's operation, the cost of labor is the reason their produce prices are higher. I need to pay my workers and raise their wages, he said. The market is open from 8 a.m. to 1 p.m. on Wednesdays and Saturdays until October 29th. For more information on the market and vendors, you can visit www.farmersmarketsiouxcity.com. And there's also a picture showing tomatoes and peppers on a table at C. Brown Gardens and Farm Fresh Beef's stand at the Sioux City Farmers Market on Wednesday in Sioux City. Vendors have had to increase prices on most, if not all, of their items due to rising operating costs. Supervisors, sheriff, argue about pay. And this comes to us from Caitlin Yamada of the Sioux City Journal, from Sioux City. Woodbury County Sheriff Chad Sheehan wants to give supplemental pay to his percentage deputies without the Board of Supervisors' approval, but the supervisors and assistant county attorney believe it is illegal. Sheehan argued with the supervisors regarding the grounds for his proposed supplemental pay at Tuesday's board meeting. Assistant County Attorney Joshua Widman said he believes it would not be the proper way to move forward. Sheehan said he can do with the money in his budget as he sees fit. Sheehan said after consulting the outside legal counsel of Douglas Phillips with Class Law Firm, he is moving forward with paying $49,600 in total to five sheriff's deputies out of his approved budget without board approval. There is no legal basis in Iowa code or case law that supplemental pay must be approved by the Board of Supervisors, Sheehan said of Phillips' opinion. Widman asked for a written legal opinion from Phillips to review. The supplemental pay would be for the extra time the five individuals have spent on the new law enforcement center project and on radio and IT work, Sheehan said. Two lieutenants would receive $8,800 each, two captains would receive $10,000 each, and one chief deputy would receive $12,000. Sheehan said his fiscal year 22 budget will have around $200,000 in extra money. Part of the extra money is due to turnover in personnel. Other extra funds are from the jail budget funds, transportation funds, and administrative funds. The supplemental pay would be pulled from the extra money that would normally be returned to the county, he said. Supplemental pay is permissible for additional services, but Widman said, in his analysis, it would be determined by the Board of Supervisors. He said Tuesday he believes Sheehan does not have the authority to issue it himself without board approval. Sheehan said he was originally going to bring the supplemental payments to the supervisors for approval, but was told it would never pass and decided to seek another legal opinion. Sheehan has requested County Auditor Pat Gill sign and send the checks on Wednesday as a one-time payment. Widman said this could cause Gill to be personally liable if a court found Sheehan's decision illegal. If it is legal on my behalf, he'd be interfering with me carrying out my legal authority as the elected sheriff, Sheehan responded. The Journal was unsuccessful in reaching Gill for comment. And the other front page story is headlined, Davis found guilty of murder for toddler's death. And this comes to us from Nick Heitrich of the Sioux City Journal from Sioux City. The soft sobbing began as soon as the word guilty came from District Judge Todd Deck's mouth. The two families hoping for opposite verdicts experiencing the same reaction. One family relieved at the thought of justice for a little girl whose life ended prematurely. The other family distraught, knowing a loved one had just been found guilty of a crime that will land him in prison for the rest of his life. After roughly 2 hours of deliberations, A Woodbury County jury of 6 men and 6 women on Wednesday found Tavon Davis guilty of first-degree murder, child endangerment resulting in the death of a child, and multiple acts of child endangerment for the August 2018 death of 19-month-old Maylin Myers, who never regained consciousness after Davis and Maylin's grandmother rushed the unresponsive girl to a Sioux City emergency room. She died 3 days later at an Omaha hospital. Davis showed no visible emotions after the verdicts were announced. Maylin's family immediately left the courtroom after the verdict and went to the Woodbury County Attorney's Office to meet with prosecutors. A victim's advocate said the family did not wish to make a statement. Davis's family, as well as public defenders Jennifer Solberg and Lori Kleinschmidt, also declined to comment. Davis, 26, of Sioux City, faces a mandatory sentence of life in prison for murder. The other two charges both carry 50-year prison sentences. DEC did not immediately set a sentencing date. Prosecutors said the death was the result of weeks of abuse by Davis. He told investigators he had dropped the girl after giving her a bath and she stopped breathing. Throughout 6 days of trial, prosecutors used witness testimony and evidence to convince jurors that Davis injured the girl numerous times while watching the child in the Sioux City apartment he shared with the girl's mother, Shannon Myers. The girl's health had deteriorated since August 1, the beginning of a period in which Davis spent more time watching the girl alone while Myers was at work. In Maylin's final 3 weeks of life, Myers and her mother took the girl to the doctor repeatedly for illness and other physical ailments doctors struggled to diagnose. The night before she lost consciousness, Maylin was a sluggish child who hardly touched her favorite meal of McDonald's chicken nuggets and French fries. In closing arguments, Iowa Attorney General Nicole Leonard showed jurors a photo of Maylin hooked up to a ventilator in the hospital. None of the defense's arguments that Maylin was accidentally hurt when Davis dropped her or tried to revive her could explain the toddler's severe injuries. That little girl didn't end up this way because of CPR. That little girl ended up this way because the defendant repeatedly beat her until her body broke down and couldn't take it anymore, Leonard said. A medical examiner ruled Maylin's death a homicide caused by blunt force injuries. The girl's long list of injuries included bruising on her forehead and back, bleeding throughout the brain, a torn blood vessel to her left kidney, hemorrhaging in both eyes, the abdomen, and in the muscles at the back of her neck, bone fractures, both new and healing, in both legs and arm, 2 vertebrae, and several ribs. Medical experts disagreed on the possible causes. The state's witnesses concluded the injuries were caused by trauma of a force similar to being in a car crash. A defense expert disagreed, offering alternative medical explanations that, he concluded, showed the injuries were accidental or occurred naturally because Maylin had stopped breathing for several minutes before she was revived in the emergency room. The fact doctors couldn't agree should raise enough reasonable doubt in jurors' minds to acquit Davis, Kleinschmidt said in the defense's closing arguments. This isn't an intentional murder, she said. Tavon Davis is not a monster. Tavon Davis did not beat Maylin to death. The state's witnesses didn't even offer any ideas how Davis might have caused the injuries, Kleinschmidt said, and ignored Davis's explanation and the fact that the girl's mother and grandmother also spent long hours alone with Maylin. It's a case about the search for a reason and why the search for someone to blame for the loss of a child, Kleinschmidt said. But those injuries all had one thing in common, Assistant Woodbury County Attorney Christine Timmons said. According to doctors' estimates on the age of the injuries, all fit into a time period when Davis spent several days watching Maylin by himself. She wasn't in a car accident. She wasn't in a multi-story fall. She was with the defendant, Timmons said. Water main break still causes downtown problems. This comes to us from Jared McNett of the Sioux City Journal. It's not a full return to business as usual for some buildings one day after a downtown water main break near the intersection of 5th and Pierce Streets. While Orpheum Theater Board of Directors President David Bernstein said that a temporary repair was able to let the venue reopen without any threat to the Thursday night showcase of legendary doo-wop groups, Sioux City Library Director Helen Rigdon said there still wasn't any water pressure in the downtown location as of Wednesday morning. We've been trying to get the city to put in a new water main for years. They've been aware of this. It's just one block and it keeps breaking over and over again. It's just frustrating, Bernstein said over the phone. During a Tuesday afternoon press conference, Sioux City Public Works Director David Carney said the 110-plus-year-old cast iron water main has seen at least three breaks in the past year or so, with two of those being right in front of the Orpheum. The latest incident forced a segment of Pierce Street to winnow down to one lane to accommodate the repair work. On Wednesday, crews remained. Carney said the city intends to replace the water main, but bids on the project were rejected after they came in 50% higher than the city had estimated, so the work likely won't be done until 2023. Until such work is finished at the library, which will likely require plumbers, Rigdon said the Alps branch doesn't have working toilets or available water, as outside temperatures now routinely threaten to push above 90 degrees. It's sad that it happened at this time of year. We have summer reading going on with lots of kids and families, Rigdon said. The local page has a picture of the fire going on at 2130 Roosevelt Street yesterday, and it shows a picture of Sioux City fire rescue workers working to put out the fire at the 2130 Roosevelt Street location in Sioux City's Riverside neighborhood on Wednesday. And you can see footage of the crews working to put out the Roosevelt Street house fire if you go to the link. Wayne State announces $26.5 million athletic facility upgrades. This comes to us from the Journal staff from Wayne, Nebraska. Wayne State College has announced plans for a $26.5 million athletic and recreation facilities upgrade. The project, set to begin in the spring of next year with a tentative completion date in the fall of 2025, includes an air-supported, domed indoor sporting facility and major renovations to the College Recreation Center, Rice Auditorium, and the Kirk Gardner Indoor Athletic Complex, according to a press release from Wayne State. Construction will take place in three phases, beginning with the indoor air dome facility, which will be connected to the college's recreation center. Inside the air dome, the centerpiece of the project will be an indoor multifunction practice, competition, and recreational space with artificial turf and an indoor 300-meter synthetic track surface. The air dome structure will also create enhanced indoor throws and jump areas in new men's and women's track and field locker rooms and office space. In addition to providing practice and competition space for varsity programs, club sports, and intramural activities, the facility will provide opportunities for regional service through competitions, youth camps, and sports leagues. Enrollment at Wayne State has grown 20% in the past 3 years, according to the press release, with 200% growth in club sports, 25% growth in intramural sports participation, and two varsity athletic programs being added. The expansion of sports at Wayne State necessitated the facility's upgrade, the college said. The Recreation Center and Alley expansion will feature a larger student weight room and an auxiliary weight room for intercollegiate athletics, club sports, and academics. The renovated recreation center will have increased space for student fitness, including additional basketball, volleyball, recreational court space, cardio equipment, multi-use fitness spaces, and overall improvement of pedestrian flow between facilities that includes patron access to Rice Auditorium. Renovations at the auditorium will increase the size of the lobby to support ticketing and concessions for the intercollegiate athletic programs and the creation of a practice court in the current Kirk Gardner Indoor Athletic Complex for women's volleyball, men's and women's basketball, club sports, and intramural activities. The upgrades are intended to raise the recruiting and competitive profile of Wayne State's NCAA Division II athletic programs while also boosting retention and improving the student athlete experience, the college said. The Wayne State Foundation is fundraising to supplement the college funds that will finance the projects. And we turn now to the opinion page, and we have an Other Voices editorial. This comes to us from the Des Moines Register, and the headline reads, Amendment Would Eliminate Limits on Deadly Weapons. Again, this is an Other Voices editorial from the Des Moines Register. Everybody purports to want something to be done about the circumstances that permitted the rifle slaughter of 19 schoolchildren and two educators in Texas last month. In a familiar pattern, something isn't happening. The massacre implicated questions about entrance security at schools and police competence, but the bulk of debate has focused on this question. Can laws make it less likely for dangerous people to procure instruments of mass murder without compromising the Bill of Rights? Congress's answer for years has been an emphatic no. In Iowa, we have an opportunity this year to do something without the aid of government representatives. At the ballot box in November, we can reject a proposed constitutional amendment that could frustrate even broadly popular efforts to keep Iowans safer from gun violence. Even maintaining the status quo in this way would count as a victory for protecting lives. A no vote would indicate that most Iowans want to preserve at least the possibility of some limits on access to deadly weapons and don't want to tie the hands of lawmakers and the judiciary. Supporters have pointed out that adding, quote, the rights of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed, end quote, to Iowa's Constitution would bring us in line with almost every other state by including a mirror of the federal Second Amendment in the state charter. That's fine, but the amendment would do more, prescribing that any restriction on gun rights be subject to strict scrutiny. This legal term requires courts to evaluate laws with the highest skepticism, striking them down as unconstitutional unless they serve a compelling government interest and are narrowly tailored to achieve that end. This provision would complicate even modest regulations. For example, supposed lawmakers, in response to two executions outside an Ames church, wished to make it less likely that people suspected or convicted of domestic abuse would be able to shoot their victims. A fraught undertaking, to be sure. People who assault partners might very well ignore demands to hand over their weapons, and the accused always have rights to due process. But under strict scrutiny, even the people's elected representatives thoughtfully balance, even if the people's elected representative thoughtfully balance these competing interests and arrive at a solution with the aim of saving lives, their efforts could be cast aside for not meeting every prong of the judicial test. Of course, existing regulations could face challenge too. Three other states, Alabama, Louisiana, and Missouri, already require strict scrutiny of arms restrictions. Todd Pettis, a University of Iowa law professor, concluded in a 2019 law review essay that strict scrutiny amendments were proving less meaningful than expected, with courts in those states sometimes concluding that strict scrutiny protections didn't apply in certain instances, circumstances. Furthermore, Louisiana and Missouri courts have applied strict scrutiny and still upheld laws restricting felons from possessing firearms. That's a little reassuring. On the other hand, when the U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments last year about New York State's discretionary system of granting licenses to carry firearms, Justice Sonia Sotomayor asked a Justice Department lawyer about restrictions on people who are mentally ill or who have been convicted of felonies. Can any of those pass strict scrutiny on their face? I don't know, answered Acting Solicitor General Brian Fletcher. Iowa need not risk the possibility of dangerous outcomes here. There are limits on free speech. There can and should be limits on the right to bear arms. The legislature in the past dozen years or so has incrementally chipped away at barriers to acquiring, traveling, and using weapons. Lawmakers stripped sheriffs of their discretion to deny weapons carrying permits and later did away with permit requirements and have allowed the use of deadly force in more situations. Iowans are free today to obtain, keep, and carry guns and rifles. When children are slaughtered by firearms in Des Moines, in Texas, around the country, it's fair to debate whether a modest concession of that freedom might help avert a tragedy. We shouldn't make that debate any harder than it already is. The choice is ours. Vote no on this amendment. And again, this was an Other Voices editorial that comes to us from the Des Moines Register. And the opinion page includes information how you can submit an opinion. If you want to, you may call 712-293-4218 or 1-800-397-9820, extension 4218. You may also email letters to letters@siouxcityjournal.com. You can fax them to 712-279-5059, or you may write an opinion and send it to Opinion, the Journal, 515 Pavonia Street, Sioux City, Iowa, 51101. And the frequently asked question of the day is, where can I find a story from 1977 on your website? And the short answer is you can't, because those papers predate the internet. We don't have them available for access. You can go back to 2000, however, to find stories from the last 20 plus years. If you want to see those pre-2000 years, check out the microfilm at the Wilbur Alfs Library in Sioux City. It has all of our papers, yep, even the first one, available to scan. All of our archives are also available at newspapers.com, which is a paid subscription service. And if you have a question for FAQ, send it to bmiller@siouxcityjournal.com or mail it to Bruce Miller, Sioux City Journal, 515 Pavonia Street, Sioux City, Iowa, 51101. It's half past the hour and time now to turn to the obituaries. The first obituary comes to us from Peoria, Arizona, formerly Sioux City. Nancy L. McBride, 92, of Peoria, Arizona, and formerly of Sioux City, passed away on Tuesday, May 24th. She was buried with her husband in Phoenix. Nancy was born on October 6, 1929 in Sioux City, the daughter of Celia Asmussen Bogenreef and Ed Asmussen. She grew up in Sioux City, graduating from Leeds High School in 1947. She then attended Morningside College and taught in the Des Moines school system. Nancy married Jim McBride from Sioux City. From Pleasant Hill, Iowa, formerly Holstein, Iowa, and May City, Iowa, Beverly J. Kraft, 79, died Monday, June 20th. Graveside services will be June 24th at 10 a.m. at Liberty Cemetery in Calumet, Iowa. Visitation will be June 23rd from 5 to 8 p.m. Nicholas D. Jensen Funeral Home of Holstein is in charge of arrangements. From Shawnee, Kansas, formerly Sioux City, Jesse Michael Johnson. Jesse Michael Johnson, 29, of Shawnee and formerly of Sioux City, passed away Monday, June 20th, after a valiant battle with mental illness. In celebration of his life, there will be an open house gathering at 1 p.m. on Saturday at Jesse's father's residence. A private burial will be planned at a later date. Jesse was born on June 10th, 1993, to Scott Johnson and Lisa Wilson in Sioux City. As a child, Jesse enjoyed spending time with his family and helping his grandfather with construction projects. This led Jesse to discovering working as his own boss as an independent licensed contractor and specifically enjoyed flipping houses. Jesse recently moved from California to Shawnee with a goal of owning his own acreage. From Sioux City, Sharon A. Magar Asmussen. Sharon Arlene Magar Asmussen, 86, of Sioux City, was called home peacefully to our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ on Monday, June 20th. Services will be at 1 p.m. on Saturday at Meyer Brothers Colonial Chapel with Reverend Todd Schlitter officiating. Burial will follow at Grant Cemetery in rural Rodney, Iowa. Visitation with family present will begin at 11 a.m. on Saturday at the funeral home. Online condolences may be offered to the family at www.meyerbroschapels.com. Sharon was born April 14, 1936, in Smithland, Iowa, to Francis and Dorothy Miller Magar. They moved to Sioux City, and Sharon graduated from Leeds High School in 1954. Sharon married Neil Asmussen on February 8, 1957. Sharon worked as an administrative assistant after high school for some allergy physicians until she had her firstborn. Then she devoted her life to raising her children. Later, she returned to the workforce, spending time at JCPenney, customer service, Meyer Brothers Funeral Home, Pioneer Teletechnologies, a long lines company of Chuck Long's. Sharon was meticulous at her position there in verification and received many awards, including the President's Telesales Award of Excellence. Sharon was on a bowling league for years, and she was part of a weekly coffee club that has been meeting for over 60 years. Sharon was a lifelong reader, and especially loved Pearl Buck and poet Edgar Guest's works. Sharon loved to antique with her mother, finding many treasures. From Lamar's, David Lang. David Lang, 80, died Monday, June 20th. Services will be June 25th at 10:30 a.m. at Trinity Lutheran Church in Hinton. Burial will be following the services in Trinity Lutheran Cemetery, Hinton, with military honors. Visitation will be June 25th from 9:30 a.m. until service time at the church. Arrangements are with Rex Winkle Funeral Home in Lamar's. From Whiting, formerly Castana, Carolyn R. Brockman. Carolyn R. Brockman, 79, died Saturday, June 18th. Services will be June 25th at 10 a.m. at Gosler Funeral Home Chapel in Onawa. Live stream is available at the funeral home's website. Burial will be following the services in Little Sioux Township Cemetery in Smithland. Visitation will be June 24th from 5 to 7 p.m. at the funeral home. Arrangements are with Gosler Funeral Home and Monuments of Onawa. From McCook Lake, Charles B. Lingle. Charles B. Lingle, 94, died Tuesday, June 21st. Services will be June 24th at 2 p.m. Meyer Brothers Morningside Chapel is in charge of arrangements. Burial will be following the services in Memorial Park Cemetery. Visitation will be 1 hour prior to service time at the funeral home. From Sioux City, Leroy Rosenbaum. Leroy Rosenbaum, 81, of Sioux City, passed away on Monday, June 20th. Services will be at 1 p.m. on Friday at Meyer Brothers Colonial Chapel. Burial will follow at Calvary Cemetery in Sioux City. Visitation with family present will begin at noon on Friday at the funeral home. Online condolences may be offered to the family at www.meyerbroschapels.com. Leroy was born on May 28, 1941, in rural Elk Point, to Virgil and Madonna Kneebone Rosenbaum. He grew up outside Elk Point until moving to Sioux City. In 1961, Leroy wed the love of his life, his Shirley Ann O'Dea. Leroy and Shirley welcomed children, and Leroy made a career as an optician until his retirement in 2006. He enjoyed numerous hobbies, including fishing, woodworking, karaoke, taekwondo, and even earning a black belt in his 60s. From Remsen, Iowa, Assy Aputu, and that's spelled A-S-Y-A-U-P-U-T-I-W. Assy Aputu, 66, of Remsen, died Saturday, June 18th. Arrangements are with Maurer Johnson Funeral Home in Lamars. And finally, from Lamars, Darvin W. Ladenthin, 76, of Lamars, died Tuesday, June 21st. Arrangements are with Maurer Johnson Funeral Home in Lamars. We return to the local and state page, and we read, South Dakota AG convicted on two impeachment charges. This comes to us from Pierre, South Dakota. The South Dakota Senate on Tuesday convicted Attorney General Jason Roundsburg of two impeachment charges stemming from a 2020 fatal crash, removing and barring him from future office in a stinging rebuke that showed most senators didn't believe his account of the crash. Roundsburg, a first-term Republican who only recently announced he wouldn't seek re-election, showed little emotion as senators convicted him of committing a crime that caused someone's death. They then delivered another guilty verdict on a malfeasance charge that alleged he misled investigators and misused his office. Roundsburg told a 911 dispatcher the night of the crash that he might have struck a deer or other large animal and has said he didn't know he struck a man, 55-year-old Joseph Beaver, until he returned to the scene the next morning. Criminal investigators said they didn't believe some of Roundsburg's statements, and several senators made clear they didn't either. There's no question that it was a lie, said Senator Lee Schoenbeck, the chamber's top-ranking Republican. This person ran down an innocent South Dakotan. Schoenbeck also criticized Roundsburg for declining to testify in his own defense, saying Roundsburg should have shared what the hell he was doing the night of the crash. There's a mic right there, and that's a damn short walk, Schoenbeck said. The convictions required a two-thirds majority in the Senate, controlled 32-3 by the Republicans. Senators mastered the bare minimum 24 votes to convict Roundsburg on the first charge, with some senators saying the two misdemeanors he pleaded guilty to weren't serious enough crimes to warrant impeachment. The malfeasance charge, Roundsburg also asked investigators what data could be found on his cell phone, among other things, sailed through with 31 votes. Votes to bar Roundsburg from future office taken on both counts were unanimous. Roundsburg's face showed little emotion throughout the votes, holding his hand over his mouth as he had for much of the trial, then writing on a notepad in his lap. He did not answer questions from reporters as he exited the Capitol. Roundsburg in September agreed to an undisclosed settlement with Beaver's widow. Nick Nemec, Beaver's cousin, who has been a constant advocate for severe punishment for Roundsburg, said the votes were vindication. It's just a relief. It's been nearly 2 years that this has drug on, and it just feels like a weight off my shoulders, he said. Roundsburg is the first official to be impeached and convicted in South Dakota history. Governor Kristi Noem, who will pick Roundsburg's replacement until the candidate elected to replace him in November is sworn in, called for her fellow Republican to resign soon after the crash and later pressed lawmakers to pursue impeachment. As the saga dragged on, Noem publicly endorsed Roundsburg's predecessor, Republican Marty Jackley, for election as his replacement. The governor celebrated the impeachment conviction on Twitter, saying it had lifted the dark cloud over the Attorney General's office. It is now time to move on and begin to restore confidence in the office, she said, but gave no indication as to who she will pick for the interim position. Roundsburg has argued that the governor, who has positioned herself for a possible 2024 White House bid, pushed for his removal in part because he had investigated ethics complaints against Noem. As the impeachment trial opened Tuesday, prosecutors drove at a question that has hung over developments since September 2020 collision. Did Roundsburg know he killed a man the night of the crash? Quote, he absolutely saw the man that he struck in the moments after, said Alex Tracy, the Clay County State's attorney who led the prosecution. Prosecutors also told senators that Roundsburg had used his title, quote, to set the tone and gain influence, end quote, in the aftermath after the crash, even as he allegedly made misstatements and outright lies to the crash investigators. The prosecution played a montage of audio clips of Roundsburg referring to himself as the Attorney General. Prosecuting attorneys probed Roundsburg's alleged misstatements during and after the crash, including that he never drove excessively over the speed limit, that he had reached out to Beaver's family to offer his condolences, and that he had not been browsing on his phone during his drive home. The prosecution played a series of video clips during their closing arguments that showed Roundsburg's shifting account of his phone use during the interviews with criminal investigators. The attorney general at first outright denied he had been using his phone while driving, but then acknowledged he had been looking at his phone minutes before the crash. When it was time for senators to speak, several noted an accident reconstruction that found Roundsburg's car had veered entirely out of its lane, in contrast to his initial statement that he was in the middle of the road at the time of impact. Roundsburg resolved the criminal case last year by pleading no contest to a pair of traffic misdemeanors, including making an illegal lane change and using a phone while driving, and was fined by a judge. We turn now to the sports page, and the top headline is, I picked the right school. And this article is accompanied by a picture showing Iowa student athletes Amber Asoff, Seth Benson, Monty Potterbaum, Jerqueva Henderson, and Linda Zivat signing autographs for fans Wednesday at Southern Hills Mall in Sioux City. I picked the right school. This story comes to us from Zach James of the Sioux City Journal from Sioux City. In just two seasons, Amber Asoff has already seen what she is capable of inside the University of Iowa running program. She showed herself this past track and field season just how good she can be. The Bishop Heelan High School grad continues on her trajectory. It definitely has taken a lot of miles, Asoff said. It's exciting to see the growth over the last couple of years. Seeing I'm on these top 10 lists and knowing I'm a few seconds from school records, it's really exciting. It's very motivating for me. It's something I want to accomplish this upcoming year. Asoff was one of five Iowa student athletes to attend the student iClub meet and greet event Wednesday at Shields at Southern Hills Mall. Asoff was one of two local athletes, West Lyon grad and Iowa football season senior Monty Potterbaum was the other. The former Crusaders standout runner, who is listed as a freshman on her Iowa Hawkeyes biography, has already put herself into the record book with the Hawkeyes. At the Iowa State Indoor Classic on February 11th, Asoff ran the one-mile run in 4 minutes, 41.58 seconds. She placed fifth in that event, and it was also the fifth fastest time in Iowa history in that race. Later on in the season, as the Big Ten Championships, Asoff anchored the distance medley relay team that turned in the second fastest time in school history. Asoff also, this indoor season, won the 800 in the Notre Dame-hosted Mayo Invitational. In the outdoor season, Asoff also put in a 4:27 time in the 1500 and helped the distance medley relay squad to record top 10 marks there. It was surprising at first, Asoff said. I'm really thankful for the coach I have. I'm thankful that Coach Randy Hassenbank believed in me this entire time. He only has higher expectations for me moving forward. She won a cross-country race at Bradley in an event as unattached runner. This year was a big growth year, and it's been fun to see the growth from freshman year and even from high school, Asoff said. There were a lot more miles added on. Freshman year was just a shock to me. That's a way with a lot of different sports, but especially running. I know I picked the right school with how much I've grown. As a freshman, whenever Asoff crossed the finish line, she was excited. She was happy just to have finished a college race. Now that she has a couple top tens under her belt, she wants the same progression of success she had throughout her time at Healing. Seeing those differences with her times, Asoff now realizes that the training she's put in the last two school years is starting to pay off. My body is finally ready for that, Asoff said. I kept thinking, this year could be different for me. I got a lot of miles under my legs, and I'm excited to see where my cross-country and track will take me. Potabom admitted at the event Wednesday that it's odd to think this is his final season with the Hawkeyes. He remembers like it was just yesterday that he was playing for the Wildcats and Coach Jay Roseboom. Potabom goes into his final season with high expectations, both personally and as a team. We didn't lose really that many people, and we have another year with everyone playing together, so I think going through spring ball and summer will help us grow even more as a team, Potabom said. It hasn't hit me yet. Potabom got some snaps at the fullback position, including against Iowa State and Nebraska. His season high in yards came against that comeback win against the Huskers, as the former Wildcats standout had two carries for 29 yards. He also had double-digit yards against Maryland and Purdue. He earned two carries for 8 yards against the Cyclones. Potabom moved from linebacker to fullback during the 2019 fall camp. The Hawkeye senior said on Wednesday night he might get some snaps at tight end, but primarily out of a blocking role. We'll have to see how that goes, and hopefully it's the best year yet, Potabom said. Coaches are going to put me in there because they trust me and they think of me highly. I'm going to do my job. Potabom didn't say who was going to be the starting quarterback between Spencer Petras and Alex Padilla. Iowa also sent Seth Benson from the football team to participate, while gymnastics athletes Jerqueva Henderson and Linda Zivot also attended. In another story from the sports page, Leave a Legacy, and this is accompanied by a picture showing Hinton's Bella Badar hitting the ball during Hinton versus Lawton Bronson softball action in Hinton on Tuesday, June 21st. This comes to us from Bailey Zubke of the Sioux City Journal from Hinton. When the Hinton Blackhawks trotted onto the field for their game with Lawton Bronson Tuesday night, 6 of the Blackhawks' 10 starters were seniors, and that group is looking to take advantage of one last season together. I think it means a lot to them, Hinton head coach Jennifer Jacobs said. I think COVID made us all kind of realize that not everything in life is a given. And for those girls, they've had a year where they've been through adversity in other sports, but they've also had success. The success for the team continued Tuesday when Hinton defeated Lawton Bronson 13-1 in 4 innings. It is Hinton's 8th straight win after an 8-8 start to the season. It's just a situation where we're realizing and finding our groove, Jacobs said. We're a small school. We've got kids doing track. We've got kids doing golf. We've got kids doing all kinds of extracurriculars. So for us to have practice together, I think we had one practice altogether before our first game. Hinton has won 10 of its last 11 games, with the lone loss coming against Bishop Heelan on June 10th. During that stretch, the Blackhawks haven't allowed more than 3 runs while scoring 3 or more in every game, not counting the loss. It's just a situation where the more opportunities that we get to be together and the more opportunities we get to gel and mesh, the better we should be, Jacob said, and that's how we want to be. We don't want to start out hot and then end up cold, so hopefully we're just going to be able to keep rolling. And in some roundup news, Heelan softball sweeps north. Angel Shaw tallied 2 hits and 2 RBIs to lead Heelan to a 14-5 win over North. Kenley Meese and Ella Fitzpatrick tallied 2 hits each for the Crusaders. Shaw also struck out 13 batters over 7 innings in the win. Heelan 12, North 1 in Game 2. Kenley Meese tallied 3 hits, including a home run and 4 RBIs for Heelan in a 12-1 win over North. Angel Shaw added 3 hits for the Crusaders. Marin Frazee struck out 6 over 6 innings in the win. East 15, West 3 in Game 1. Gracie Bruning and Alexis Jones tallied 2 hits and 2 RBIs each for East in a 15-3 win over West. Briley Hempe tallied 2 hits and 1 RBI at the plate while pitching 3 innings for the Black Raiders. Bree Locar tallied 2 hits for West, and Alice Fetteplace took the loss. And East 9, West 2, in Game 2, Olivia Menser tallied 3 hits and 2 RBIs for East in a 9-2 win over West. Kennedy Wineland, Alexis Jones, and Addison Jungi tallied 2 hits each for the Black Raiders. Cadence Ford struck out 4 over 7 innings. Bree Locher tallied 2 hits for West, and Ann Fetteplace took the loss. And this story came to us from Bailey Zubke from the Sioux City Journal. And this brings us to the end of reading the Sioux City Journal for today, Thursday, June 23rd, 2022. If you have any questions or comments for Iris, please give us a call toll-free at 1-877-404-4747. Thank you for listening to your Sioux City Journal.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date. Sometimes we have too much electricity, but more often, grid operators are carefully managing its production to be sure that we have enough. So, a lot of work has gone into trying to store excess electricity to use later when we need it. The obvious solution, giant batteries, is still too expensive for most applications and has environmental implications. This has led scientists to look for other ways. One method uses surplus power to compress air and pump it into old salt mines. The salt tends to seal cracks in the walls, making the mines airtight. When needed, the compressed air can be released to turn a turbine, or it can be used as the intake air for a natural gas power plant, making the plant more productive. Another way to store excess energy is to pump water uphill into existing reservoirs and then release it through hydroelectric dams when power is needed. This method was pioneered 100 years ago in Italy and Switzerland and is used today around the world and in many U.S. states, like Michigan. On the Chilean coast, they're even experimenting with using solar energy to pump seawater up a cliff where it could flow down to make power at night. These solutions don't make economic sense unless the electricity is very cheap and the reservoir was already built for another purpose. But when those two things are present, pumping air and water to store energy plays a valuable role in balancing the grid to meet our ever-changing power demands. For Earth Date, I'm Scott Tinker.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.